So what happens if a satellite loaded with plutonium plopped down on planet Earth or landed and smashed into a populated area? What would happen? That's another story Linda Moulton-Howe checks into next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Linda Moulton-Howe with us. Linda, how many satellites are up there that might have plutonium?
They think that it is at least 30. It's more than you would think.
That's 30 too much.
Yes, it is. And a report in 2011 by the U.S. National Research Council warned NASA that the amount of orbiting space debris is at a critical level. According to some computer models, the amount of space debris, quote, has reached a tipping point with enough currently in orbit to continually collide and create even more debris, raising the risk of spacecraft failures, close quote. Think of this as bumper cars now. If there are 30-some up there that are old and have got plutonium in them, and the place is so crowded with thousands of pieces of debris, then the likelihood of something hitting one of these just right is the big issue here, because it could knock it down onto the ground. And this report is calling for trying to get the world together for international regulations to limit debris and come up with ways to get rid of it. The number of satellites above Earth that were launched with nuclear reactors powering them by the Soviet Union between the 1950s to 1988 is at least 30, still up there orbiting. There was also one from the United States, the Navy's SNAP series, and that was SNAP 10A that entered into an orbit about 575 miles above the Earth in 1965. It operated for 43 days, and then, for some reason, it stopped responding. It drifts up there in a slow trajectory. It has radioactive material in it. The question is, if it just drifted and nothing ever hits it, it could stay up there for 2,000 or 3,000 years, and then it would be a problem later on. But in a debris field as crowded as the one around Earth now, a collision becomes increasingly likely, that the right force and direction could knock something like that SNAP 10A out of its orbit to a premature crash, and that could spread plutonium or other radioactive particles on our Earth. And that's what happened to the Soviet Cosmos 954 satellite. It was powered by a nuclear reactor containing about 110 pounds of uranium-235. The satellite was supposed to be a Soviet eye in the sky for a very long time, but by mid-December of 1977, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, that we know as NORAD, noticed that the Cosmos 954 was moving erratically, and then it changed altitude in its orbit. It went up 50 miles, and then they learned that Soviet technicians were trying to control a spacecraft that was clearly going out of control. The Soviets wanted to put the satellite into a graveyard orbit where the nuclear reactor core would be safely out of trouble, but that failed, and the nuclear-powered satellite crashed into Canada's Northwest Territories. From late January to late April 1978, a joint Canadian-American team swept 48,000 square miles by foot and by air looking for the crashed Cosmos 954 satellite's radioactive debris. And they found a dozen large pieces with radiation measuring 1.1 sieverts per hour. One fragment had a radiation level of 500 Rankines per hour, which, quote, is sufficient to kill a person remaining in contact with that piece for only a few hours, close quote. An exposure of 500 Rankines, which is equivalent to 5 sieverts, in 5 hours is usually lethal for human beings. And Russia had to pay Canada $10 million for that damage. Now, journalism professor Carl Grossman at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury, New York, has written extensively about nuclear technology and environmental impacts. One of his books released in 2001 is entitled The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. When the Tech Insider headlined in early March, quote, "Dozens of dead nuclear reactors are floating in space and they will eventually hit the Earth," I called Professor Grossman for a reality check. Here now from Old Westbury, New York, is Professor Carl Grossman.
Well, that's the bad news, that there are these dozens of devices up there overhead full of poisonous material, and they're going to eventually come down. I mean, Newton's law of gravity is still operable. What goes up comes down. And the Soviet Union and the United States sent up lots of nuclear-powered satellites. We're talking back in the 50s and 60s. These days, all our satellites are powered by solar power. So is the International Space Station. In fact, we could have done it then. We could have done solar-powered satellites in space. But the notion then, and this still exists, is that nuclear power is fine and dandy. Indeed, the author of this article headlined, "Dozens of dead nuclear reactors are floating in space, and they'll eventually hit the Earth." That's the rather scary and accurate headline. There's so much junk, there's so much garbage up in space, bolts and nuts and debris of all sorts. I mean, every once in a while, they got to shift around the International Space Station because they're fearful of it getting hit with debris. The military keeps track of the tens of thousands of orbiting pieces of space debris. NASA had to work with the military to get that shuttle up and out, weaving through some of this space debris. It's a real problem. An asteroid could hit one of the satellites. My concern is you have dozens of space nuclear systems up there, both the ones put up by the Soviet Union and those put up by us, and they're going to come down. But I would propose that somehow we try to begin thinking about retrieving these devices, figure on some sort of new garbage truck shuttle that would go up there, locate some of these nuclear space systems, 500 and 600 and 1,000 miles up, and take them down safely and eliminate them. But we're not thinking along those lines. We're thinking more nukes in space. The Soviets, a lot of these satellites were for military purposes, for surveillance. The Soviet Union didn't have very good optics, so they put their spy satellites up just a couple hundred miles up, very, very low. Indeed, what the Soviets did was attempt to raise the In fact, I'm reading here from my book, which is called The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. And I write about how the Soviet Union, I give a laundry list of some of the satellites that are up there, Cosmos 367, Cosmos 785, Cosmos 1266. And I write about how the reactors had to be boosted to higher orbit after going through various malfunctions. The Soviets felt this higher orbit, about 500, 600 miles high, would provide for more safety. U.S. space nuclear satellites, they're up there 500 to some 1,000 miles high. But eventually, they're all going to come down. Not next year, probably not in a decade, but eventually at that altitude, gravity is eventually going to get to them. And they're going to come down, and they're going to burn up in the atmosphere. And the nuclear material aboard, we use plutonium, which is regarded as the most toxic radioactive substance. Dr. Helen Caldicott, a very famous physician and anti-nuclear authority, describes plutonium as the most toxic substance in the universe. I don't know from the universe, but I know for sure that in terms of radioactive substances, it is the most toxic. Just a millionth of a gram can cause lung cancer.
The Russians were using uranium-235, right, as fissionable material.
Well, there's two types, basically, of space nuclear systems. One is using plutonium, this very, very toxic, very poisonous radioactive substance. And we used it because it emits heat. And we created, the United States, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which cause the heat of the plutonium to be translated in what's called RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, into electricity to provide the electric power for these satellites that we sent up. And we sent up a good many in what was called the SNAP series. We sent up one reactor, the SNAP-10A, in 65, but that only worked for a month and a half. Most of our systems were plutonium systems. When only a millionth of a gram disperses a little particle getting into somebody's lung can cause cancer. Now, what the Soviet Union did was to actually have nuclear reactors like little Chernobyls, little Fukushimas that the Soviets built. We built one of these kinds of things, which we used on the SNAP-10A, but by and large, we used the RTGs. The Soviets and then the Russians, what they've focused upon were actual nuclear reactors. Why? Because there were so many launch pad explosions in the Soviet space program that they just didn't want to fool around with plutonium, because if your rocket blew up on launch and it was carrying a satellite with plutonium as its fuel for an energy system, you'd have toxic plutonium all over the place. What the Soviets preferred to do was to send up a reactor and only have the reactor go critical or go on once it was in space. Then the reactors were fueled with a fissionable isotope of uranium, 235. What happens when you have a reactor, whether it's in space or on the ground, the process of fission happens. That uranium-235 is transformed into various fission products, which include strontium-90 and iodide-131, all the poisons that got out of the plants at Fukushima and the Chernobyl plant in 86. And also what occurs is that there's amounts of what's called uranium-238 when you have a mix of uranium. And what happens to that uranium-238 is that it grabs a neutron and it transforms to plutonium. It becomes plutonium-239. So you end up with reactors having plutonium involved in them, but eventually, if they're in operation in space, they produce plutonium. So the end result is nuclear poisons, whether you start off with plutonium or you end up with various fission products and also plutonium. There's military stuff up there which we don't know about. And there's been three accidents. The worst was the SNAP-9A. It was a plutonium-powered satellite. It failed to achieve orbit. It came crashing down. This is in 1964, spreading plutonium all over the Earth. Dr. John Goffman of the University of California at Berkeley, an eminent physicist and an MD, happened to have both a PhD and an MD, involved in the Manhattan Project, a co-discoverer of various isotopes of uranium and plutonium. He long connected the SNAP-9A accident with an increase of lung cancer on Earth. And in fact, in my book, The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, I document a very exhaustive report done by a group of European space agencies about how plutonium from this SNAP-9A was found. I mean, quoting from the report, it says, on all continents and at all latitudes after the 64 accident. I kept wondering, why is this being done? The issue of why, well, like in Watergate investigation, as Deep Throat tells Bob Woodward, the Washington Post, follow the money. Who's making money from these nuclear space systems? Turned out at that time it was General Electric. What was their old motto? General Electric, bring life to Earth? Quite the opposite. Then these national labs wanted to have projects going, and then I got into the military connection again. This is the 80s. We're in the middle of the Reagan Star Wars program, and it turns out that the Star Wars program was predicated on nuclear-powered battle platforms.
Gosh.
Up in space, powered by either actual nuclear reactors or super RTGs, super radioisotope thermoelectric generators. And these would provide the energy for the laser weapons and the hypervelocity guns and the particle beam weapons, which would be placed up in space as part of Star Wars. Once I got into researching that angle, there was this coupling of nuclear in space and weapons in space. NASA, though it was set up in 58 as a civilian agency, knew quickly where the money was and is in American society, the Pentagon. So it began coupling with the military and began doing, still does, dual-purpose missions. That's why with many of those shuttle missions, there was seven colonels, and you never heard, you know, anything about those missions. Those were classified missions. So I got into the story big time. And in Weapons in Space, I quote, commander of the Strategic Defense Initiative program is saying, look, if we didn't have nuclear power energizing the battle platforms in space, we'd have to have a long extension cord going down to Earth, bringing up power. I mean, it was fully admitted to be nukes in space. And here we are years later, and it's not over. The U.S. and Russia are still pursuing the use of nuclear in space big time. They want nuclear-powered rockets to send astronauts to Mars. That would be quicker. But these people who have been pushing the use of nuclear power in space, I think that they are being pretty dangerous.
Dangerous indeed, Linda.
Yeah, and in spite of the proven dangers of putting radioactive fuel in spacecraft, both Russia and the United States want to do just that to get to Mars now. The first week of March 2016, Russia's National Nuclear Corporation called Rosatom, I may not be pronouncing this correctly, it's either Rosatom or Rosatom, announced it is building a nuclear engine that will be able to get a spacecraft to Mars, get this, in a month and a half. That's
wow.
About 45 days, and that, I guess, is to be manned and still have enough fuel to return to Earth.
That is amazing. And they're also talking about 3 days.
Well, that's what we're going to get into in the next half hour. It's really exciting. But just right now, right here, we've just come through the dangers of putting nuclear or radioactive material on spacecraft going around the Earth, and now we have Russia and the United States wanting to do the same thing, launching from the Earth to Mars, and the Rosatom scientists in Russia want to try to launch a prototype by 2025. That's not very long. They need 15 billion rubles, which is about 700 million U.S. dollars. And Russia wants to test a nuclear engine in just 2 years, in 2018. Now, but beyond that big budget, there are many questions from people who say humans should not be seriously considering putting radioactive materials and humans into spacecraft and launching them out into space. Well, in the middle of March, just a couple of weeks ago, NASA Administrator Charles Bolden, in a statement to Congress, said, quote, we are on a journey to Mars, and most people believe that in the end, nuclear thermal propulsion will be the most effective form of propulsion to get there, close quote. So we're talking just right now, just 2 weeks ago. And then when you go to the, I have a photograph, it's a photograph of the Earth, but with an illustration of the proposed NASA Copernicus spacecraft that they would like to use nuclear thermal propulsion in to carry astronauts to Mars. So I've got that at Earth Files. And when you read about Copernicus, I think a lot of us had forgotten that there was in 2010, a national space policy of the United States was written and discussed with Obama that specifies NASA shall, by the end of the 2030s, send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. This is an official national mission.
That's going to happen. I can't wait for this report when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Linda Moulton Howe. With us next hour, we'll have conversations with Linda. We'll take your phone calls about these stories we're talking about. Maybe you've got some of your own ideas as well for some future stories you want to share with her. So can you imagine going from Earth to Mars in only 3 days? And what about the implications and the ramifications for just flying, going from L.A. to New York, let's say, in 20 minutes? That's all possible, too, one day, Linda.
Yeah, and we're talking about 30 minutes between Mars and Earth. If the man that I've interviewed gets the technology he's working on going. And when you look back 60 years, it's that long ago that the only one human-made machine from Earth has ever left our solar system and is now in interstellar space. And that was Voyager 1, launched in 1977. Today, NASA and Russia are both talking about building nuclear thermal propulsion spacecraft, and they want to take humans, that's weight, take size, from Earth to Mars in maybe 45 days, much shorter than the 9 months to get the rovers to Mars. But to get out of the solar system to even the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, 4.4 light years from Earth, even with nuclear thermal propulsion would be too slow to do it in a lifetime. But what if we could get up to 25% to 30% the speed of light? Then we could get to Alpha Centauri in about 17 years. It could be someone's life mission. And believe it or not, that kind of interstellar travel is already being discussed and designed by the Experimental Cosmology Group at the University of California, Santa Barbara. With a grant from NASA, physics professor Philip Lubin is investigating the possibility of using directed energy propulsion, that's basically laser photons, for interstellar travel. And more simply, he would take and create an array of lasers to beam an intense concentration of photons at what Professor Lubin calls, quote, wafer spacecraft, or the inside joke in the cosmology lab is they would call them the voyages of the Starship wafer size in real Star Trek exploration. Now, this idea of something small, it's because they want to deal with photons. And he told me the first wafer-sized spacecraft would be only 4 inches in diameter and about 100 microns thick with a 1 meter diameter reflector. That would be about 39 inches. So that means if you can imagine that you've got a reflector that's going to take the photons pushing against it, 39 inches, and it will have protected in it a small, think of your iPhone, think, or maybe an iPad. It's just loaded with all kinds of technologies and abilities. Well, the same thing would be inside of this reflector, only what is making it go is going to be photons pushing at that reflector, and that they already know that just in a few minutes, they can get up to 25% to 30% the speed of light that would take, if they launched it from the Earth, it would take, they could get there in 30 minutes, maybe as short as 8 minutes, maybe as short as 3 minutes, depending upon the photons, the amount of intensity of photons pushing against the reflector. Now, at those speeds, it's not going to be stopping at Mars, for example. This would be headed out through the solar system and out to interstellar space, maybe headed to Alpha Centauri, carrying this smart technology to receive all kinds of data from the mysterious cosmos and relay it back to Earth. This would be a real interstellar technology that could even start moving in waves as you kept launching these out in different directions into the cosmos. Here now, from Santa Barbara's Experimental Cosmology Group, is physicist Philip Lubin.
if you weren't going at 25% of the speed of light, which is the speed that we can envision for the smallest probes that we imagine, which are what we call wafer spacecraft, which are silicon or other material, those would be the first probes that we would send to the stars, not humans, not biological systems, but simply robotic systems.
Mm-hmm.
You can place an enormous amount of electronics onto relatively small systems if you go for a fully integrated system. Each wafer, each small spacecraft would have a reflector that would be tuned to the laser wavelength.
Do you mean that the wafer itself would be the beginning craft that we would send out from the Earth propelled by the photon force? You're not talking about even a spacecraft. You're talking about something that is small, like a robotic drone that would go into interstellar reaches.
Yes. If you think about spacecraft today, they tend to be human-sized things. But one can imagine many sophisticated items placed into very compact elements. So your phone is a marvel of engineering. If you think about what's in your phone, there's accelerometers, there's gyros in your phone, there's cameras, data transmission systems. Look at your phone. Imagine that the year was 1960 and someone handed you a smartphone and just said, what do you think? The response would be phenomenal. You know, how could you possibly stick all of that into a device that I can hold it in my hand and is powered by a battery which will last for a day? It was inconceivable 60 years ago or even 40 years ago in a human lifetime. But yet we've done that, and we can do much more. We can shrink many of the functionalities of what we would call a spacecraft. But really what a spacecraft does is it allows us to have an extended presence. It allows us to see. It allows us to determine composition of. It allows us to move things. It's an extension of ourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just think about yourself as what you are. You're a sensing mechanism. You touch, you move. You have the ability to do things which a robot can do in many cases. And yet a robot doesn't have to be the size of a human. A robot could be a very tiny thing, such as your phone.
You are envisioning that the first photonic propulsion systems would be these small wafer-type drones that could be moved forward by the force of photons from an array of lasers, let's say, on the moon, and that their goal would be to go beyond the solar system out into interstellar space, moving at about 25% or 30% of the speed of light. They would be our pioneers sending back signals for as long as they could send back.
Yes, I think that's stated very well. But there's another part of this which you should keep in mind. You can send out any mass you wish, but the more massive it is, the slower it goes. So if you want to get out there to the nearest stars, which are a little over 4 light years away from us, in a human lifetime, then you want to be moving at speeds which are at least 5% the speed of light, approximately a human lifetime, to get to Alpha Centauri.
But if you could go 25 to 30% the speed of light with your system, we could get to Alpha Centauri in what?
It's about 4.4 light years away. So if you're going at 1/4 the speed of light, it takes 4 times 4.4, or 17.6 years, to get to Alpha Centauri at 25% the speed of light. And that's the speed at which you could propel a single wafer spacecraft to speeds that would be sufficient to arrive at a star in much less than a human lifetime.
How would you sustain that force to get the wafer up to 25 to 30% of the speed of light and sustain it?
Well, you actually don't have to sustain it. In fact, it's much like throwing a ball. Think of yourself throwing a ball. You throw it for a fraction of a second, or a second is when you're pushing the ball, and then you let it go and it's gone. But you're not pushing it the entire distance that it travels. You simply impart a force onto it for a short period of time during the throw, and then you release it and it's gone. Same thing happens here in photonic propulsion. You push on the object as long as you need to, and that's as long as the beam is either smaller than the size of the reflector. But once you get out to a relatively large distance, the beam spreads out so that the amount of force on the spacecraft becomes diminishingly smaller. small with increased distance, so then you no longer need to push it.
And do you not need to push it because you're in the vacuum of space and you don't have air molecules or resistance once it is up to 25 to 30% the speed of light?
Yeah, basically in the interplanetary medium or the interstellar medium between stars, there's very little to slow you down.
Let's go to the question that goes beyond the first wafer frontiers of going out into interstellar space, and that is, if we wanted to move humans at 25 to 30% the speed of light with something that would be like the photonic propulsion system that you envision, what would have to evolve or change, or how would you be able to move a human or humans at that speed of light using photon propulsion?
I'm not an advocate of doing this with humans because we, as a species, were relatively risk averse to losing humans in missions, as we saw with the tragedies in some of the space programs, the shuttle in particular. So I think a human mission to the stars is something that has to be really thought out carefully. I just don't think it makes sense for many, many reasons. Humans are very fragile. They require enormous support systems to keep them alive. They're high maintenance. I try to talk to people about what we need to do to make robots without humans on board, either machine biology hybrids or artificial intelligence on machines that allows the machine to be the extension of ourselves. But let's entertain the thought of if you wanted to propel a human at speeds that was sufficient to reach the stars in less than a human lifetime, you would need a spacecraft that was very large, first of all, because you have to maintain humans, keep them alive, and I think it really becomes quite unreasonable. But if you're asking what it would take, we are currently in the midst of a revolution, much like we are in the midst of an electronics revolution that allows your phone to exist today. Whereas 50 years ago, it would have been relatively unthinkable to imagine a phone like we have today.
If in the rest of the 21st century and going into the 22nd century, we could get your wafer proposals of photonic propulsion system going into interstellar space and getting data back from them, that might set a baseline for how in the 22nd century we could start thinking about humans going, say, to Alpha Centauri?
Yes, I think that's well stated. I could imagine before the end of the 21st century that we will already have reached relativistic speeds with small payloads on our way to the stars in terms of exploration with small robotic systems. It does not have to be a wafer. It can be a small spacecraft. This technology can propel a wide variety of spacecraft, which is one of the beauties of this technology. You build a single launching system, and it can launch an armada of spacecraft of different sizes, different shapes. In the case of the wafer, for example, it only takes about 5 minutes to 25% the speed of light. And then what are you going to do for the next 30 years? You're going to start launching out the wafer every 5 or 10 years. Talk about hundreds of missions per day. Or maybe you start sending out larger missions that take longer to propel. It also enables a radical transformation of what you're able to do in other areas, not just propulsion. The original way in which we were working on the system was actually as a planetary defense program. If an asteroid is coming and is going to hit the Earth, one way to mitigate the threat is to focus a very high power and highly intense beam on the asteroid, which then causes it to boil. You cause the surface to get so hot in the area where the laser is focused that material begins to be ejected or ablated from the asteroid, which then acts as a rocket engine and pushes the asteroid back and deflects it from the Earth.
And doesn't have the problems of that we would send a nuclear missile to blow up an incoming asteroid or comet, because then we would break it up into millions of pieces that would hit the Earth.
Yeah, one of the problems with nuclear weapons is you have to get the nuclear weapon to the asteroid. You have to get it out there. The advantage of the photonic approach is you don't send anything except the light to the asteroid. So first of all, it gets there very quickly. In the case of asteroids that we discover at the last minute, we would not necessarily evaporate the asteroid. We don't actually cause it to disappear. We simply change its orbit by pushing back against the asteroid. So you're deflecting the asteroid.
And you're doing it as fast as light photon energy, and that would be at least a safe way to deflect an incoming meteorite, asteroid, or comet.
Yes. It's exactly the same system you build for photonic propulsion and you can use to defend the Earth. It's a multi-purpose system.
All kinds of possibilities there, Linda.
Yeah, it's really exciting to think about this, and that what we need now, the next step, which is what they are trying to evolve into, is how do you build these arrays of lasers and where do you put them? If you put them on Earth, it's easier because we can construct on our Earth and our gravity and we know how to do it, but there's atmosphere around the Earth. And lasers can have interference from atmosphere. So another place that's possible to put an array of lasers that would become the new light propulsion system would be on the moon. We'd have to get material to the moon and build this laser array, but once we were there, we wouldn't have any kind of an atmosphere to deal with. Well, wherever the laser array would be, let's say at the our Earth end of things, we talked about this really fun idea that if you get one of these wafers and you start forcing it, and it in a few minutes it's up to 25-30% the speed of light charging away, and let's say that now the goal is that you've got an array on Mars. This is getting into the future clearly, but it's just the fun of these concepts. You get a laser array on Mars, you have a laser array on the Earth or the Moon or all three, and you get this going halfway between the Earth and Mars. If it's down to 3 minutes, it could be a minute and a half. There could be a propulsion force from the lasers on Mars pushing back with, let's say it's information we're taking and there's something Mars gets it, that suddenly you can imagine the beginnings of a brand new solar system phone connection. Only it's not phone, it's light, and it's being done through these wafer-sized craft. And he said, you could even imagine that once you get one going at 25% the speed of light in minutes, and it's got its job, you could have another one going. These could go out in waves. And that between Earth and Mars, there could be continual, rapid communication, not landing, not carrying humans, not carrying cargo, but taking and gathering information and exchanging it.
Up next, we're going to take your calls with Linda, conversations with Linda, and you can call her about UFOs, crop formations, and everything else you've heard tonight on Coast to Coast AM.